Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to episode number 226 of Real Life Ghost Stories. And to kick things off this week, I would like to say thank you to some of our newest Patreon subscribers. I would like to thank Jessica Manning, Eileen McRae, Michael, Helen Smith, Charles Davis, Amanda Rowe, Fenja Abrams, and Misty White. Thank you so much for subscribing to the Patreon. I love you and appreciate you every single day. And our film review this week, our film review is a double whammy. I think for the first time ever, I watched two films back to back and I said, look, why not review them back to back? Because today we are reviewing both Interview with a Vampire and Queen of the Damned. Classics, some might argue. I would not. Interview with a Vampire was released in 1994. It has 7.5 out of 10 on IMDb and 63% on Rotten Tomatoes. Born as an 18th century lord, Louis is now a bicentennial vampire, telling his story to an eager biographer. Suicidal after the death of his family, he meets Lestat, a vampire who persuades him to choose immortality over death and becomes his companion. Eventually, gentle Louis resolves to leave his violent maker, but Lestat guilts him into staying by turning a young girl whose addition to the family breeds even more conflict. And Queen of the Damned was released in 2002. It has 5.2 out of 10 on IMDb and 17% on Rotten Tomatoes. In this loose sequel to Interview with the Vampire, The Vampire Chronicles from 1994, the vampire Lestat becomes a rock star whose music wakes up the equally beautiful and monstrous queen of all vampires. So listen, I'm just going to say this from the off. I know that Interview with the Vampire in particular is a film that people absolutely love and adore. So please can I caveat this by saying it is not a personal attack on you if I don't like either of these films. And I'm going to be honest, I did not like either of these films. So please don't send me abusive messages, okay? Please don't send me messages calling me stupid. Films are subjective and sometimes they're of their time. And sometimes you watch them in that time period and you love them and maybe they don't stand up to scrutiny in later years. And that's okay, okay? We don't all like the same things. So please don't send me messages that are mean. Because to be honest, I feel like I'm taking my life into my hands every time I say that I don't like a film. And because we're reviewing two films today, the breakdown of each film is going to be shorter. We're going to try and stick to the allotted 10 minutes of a film review. First of all, I don't think this was the desired impact of these films, but I did laugh a lot, which I enjoyed. You know, Nick and I sat down last Sunday afternoon and we sat down and we decided we were going to watch two films back to back, two vampire films. He wanted to watch Interview with the Vampire. I wanted to watch Queen of the Damned. And guess what? They worked together. I mean, they didn't work at all, but they worked together. So we're going to start with Interview with the Vampire, right? And Kirsten Dunst was unexpected for me in this film. I didn't know that she rocked up in the middle of the film, okay? She was like 11 or 12 years old when she filmed this, and she was really good. I thought her character was great. I mean, she was precocious and annoying as a character, but her acting was really good, and I was like, good on you, Kirsten Dunst. That is an impressive performance. I haven't read the Anne Rice novels, but I liked the story, so I liked this idea that Brad Pitt's character, Louis, is, you know, his wife and his child die and he's so overwrought with grief that he goes into self-destruct mode. And then he meets Lestat, who's like, babe, I can offer you a lifetime of no pain, no suffering and immortality. So what do you think? And Brad Pitt's character is like, sure, why not? And look, he spends the film then wrestling with the morality of being a vampire. Like, you have to kill people to survive when you're a vampire. And he is not okay with that. But unfortunately, he has this insatiable thirst for blood. And it's a great story. And he is desperately trying to hold on to like the last of his humanity. Whereas Lestat let go of his humanity a long time ago and is an all-round dickhead. And there's nothing I love more in cinema than a Byronic hero. Like, I want a hero that you look at and you're like, oh, you're such a dick, but I love you anyway. You're such a dick, but I know that if you came to me in the middle of the night, I would be like, turn me into a vampire, please. I enjoyed the idea of vampires living this like sort of nomadic, unsettled life as they move from place to place, trying to integrate themselves into society while also having to be on the outskirts of society because they're big old killers, you know. And there was one particular moment in this film that I absolutely adored that I felt like the entire movie needed more of. And there was this moment at the end where Tom Cruise is driving along as obviously Lestat, not as Tom Cruise. And he puts on the radio and the song is Sympathy for the Devil, and it's just a gorgeous moment. I think I actually cheered. I was like, woo, yeah, love it. That's the kind of camp and silliness that we want from this sort of vampire film. But to be honest, other than that, I was a bit like, meh, fine. And it has to be said here and now, right, I don't like Tom Cruise. I try not to watch films that he's associated with for various reasons. But I put my beliefs aside because Nick really wanted to watch this film. Now, there's one big problem with this, right? The glaring problem with this entire movie is that Tom Cruise shouldn't have had blonde hair. Who was the wig designer in this film, okay? Because Tom Cruise should not have had blonde hair. It was ridiculous. It was a no for me. Took me right out of the moment. All right. Lestat, I'm sorry. You were meant to be sort of sexy and Byronic, and it ended up looking silly with his blonde hair. It was ridiculous. Also, just the wig people in general, you all got it wrong. Brad Pitt's hair was just slightly too long. Antonio Banderas, when he rocked up, his hair was ridiculous. It was this waist length wig and it just didn't work. And I Kirsten Dunst, her hair, her ridiculous curls. The wig department for this film, hanging your heads in shame. You should be, okay? Because the wigs were not a good look the entire way through. And to be honest, you know, on a serious note, I just wanted it to be sexier. You know, I feel like Interview with a Vampire, I feel like it should be full of sex and lust and desire and longing. But instead, I thought it was just a bit cringy and a bit kitsch. And not very thrilling in the gothic sense, you know. I watched the first episode of the recent adaptation of Interview with the Vampire. And I was like, oh my god. That is very, very lust filled. Okay. But instead, in this instance, we got Tom Cruise being weird. And sort of sometimes doing okay. But other times just not. He did not play a good Lestat, you know. And I read somewhere that he played from scene to scene rather than playing a character. And I totally got that. It was like he just approached each scene as a completely different character rather than being like, how would Lestat behave in this scene? There were moments where he like would just start shouting randomly and it just didn't really make any sense. And listen, Louis was so boring. And so moany as a character. I was like, okay, I get it. I get that you're wrestling with your morality, but also just shut up. Like, Lestat, pick somebody better to be your companion because this guy does not stop complaining. And to be honest, the second half is weird when they go and meet all the vampires in Paris. At least, I think they were in Paris, but oh god, it was just weird. It was weird. It was convoluted. I didn't really understand what was going on for chunks of the narrative. Yeah, it wasn't for me. And can I just remind people yet again, please don't send me abusive emails or messages just because I didn't like the film. I just didn't enjoy it. I didn't feel like it aged well. And I mean, it's 30 years old. Okay, so I didn't enjoy it. I'm going to give it 2.5 stars. There you go. It was fine, but it wasn't great. But Queen of the Damned, on the other hand, was exceptionally awful. And I was really looking forward to this. The reason I wanted to watch Queen of the Damned is because I love Jonathan Davis, lead singer of Korn. Love him. Loved him for years. And when Queen of the Damned came out, I never got to watch it all those years ago, back in the early 2000s. And whenever I was a big Korn fan, which would have been a few years later. I mean, I never got to watch it. So I was really excited to see it. And the first note that I wrote down for Queen of the Damned was literally, well, it's the thought that counts. Because my God, that's a spectacularly awful film. And yeah, love Jonathan Davis, but he was not the choice for this film. And to clarify that, so the vampire Lestat is played by Stuart Townsend, and he fronts this rock band and becomes a world famous rock star that everybody loves, right? And Jonathan Davis is the voice of Stuart Townsend as that rock star, and it just doesn't work. I wanted him to be like Veal Velo from Him. You know, that kind of sort of romantic, gothic rock star. That's what I personally wanted. We didn't get it. I didn't think Jonathan Davis was the choice. Aaliyah, RIP, was absolutely stunning in this film as the Queen of the Damned. She was beautiful as Akasha. She was absolutely gorgeous. You just couldn't take your eyes off her. My word, was she stunning. But my God, Akasha was not a good character. I mean, she was beautiful, but the acting wasn't great. And I can imagine that's because she did not have very good dialogue to work with. She just sort of slinked around, and that was about it as far as character depth. Slinked around and killed people. And there genuinely were about like four different storylines in this film that were mashed together that genuinely didn't work. And I imagine with more padding in the novel, I imagine it very much did work, but it didn't work in the film because we have Lestat, the vampire Lestat, being a rock star, and he's sort of like, well, why should vampires live in the shadows? And then all the vampires in the world are like, we're going to kill that guy because he's really fucking annoying. And then you have Akasha, the Queen of the Damned, waking up randomly. She doesn't show up until like an hour and a half into the film. And then she's like, well, I'm just going to butcher my way through the world. Vampires, humans alike, I don't care. And then you also have this society who study vampires and the paranormal. And this girl who's like interested in learning about Lestat and falls in love with him and decides that she's going to follow him around and generally be a bit of a simpering dweeb. And then you've got like, you know, somehow she ends up with this link to all the old age vampires, and it just doesn't work. Dialogue awful, acting very poor, the story together doesn't work. Jonathan Davis's voice, I hate to say it, but it doesn't work in the film. However, would I watch a remake? Absolutely. You best be sure I'd watch a remake of this film. I feel like this film took itself way too seriously when actually it should have sort of embraced the ridiculousness of it and been sillier and campier and funnier. But no, it took itself really seriously, and it just wasn't very good. Maybe it gets half a star. Maybe half a star is about as much as I can stretch to. But look, in saying that, I very much enjoyed myself watching the two films. You know, I thought they were fun to watch, but were they very good? I didn't think so. So 2.5 stars for Interview with a Vampire and a paltry half a star for Queen of the Damned. I think that's only because I thought the costuming was pretty amazing.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain- and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Which brings us swiftly to our story this week. Now, 13 minutes for two film reviews. I didn't think that was bad. I think I did okay there. And our story this week was adapted from a really good article that was in the March edition of the Fortean Times. So the latest edition of the Fortean Times. So the big chunks of text from newspapers, etc., are taken from that particular article. So that is the Fortean Times issue number 442. And it was a man named Paul Cropper who investigated and wrote this article. So let's get into it. Often poltergeist stories follow a very specific pattern. A household under siege. Activity that is varied and ramps up over time, a family in crisis. But there are other poltergeist stories that stand out because they don't quite follow the convention. If you are a Patreon subscriber, you will have already heard the full version of the introduction to this story. But don't worry, it is only the introduction to the meat of the episode. In 1981, in Ward End in Birmingham, England, a group of residents on Thornton Road were under siege. Not just a single family, but a number of families on the same street. The first indication that something was wrong was when families began to hear the sounds of stones rattling against their windows, against their roofs, against their doors. Each time they checked for the perpetrators of this strange prank, they could never find anyone. Initially, it was annoying and frustrating that they couldn't find who was responsible. But soon, the throwing of the pebbles became more intense, more violent. Pebbles became small rocks being hurled at the houses, breaking windows and damaging roofs. In all, five families were falling victim to these events. And they came together to create a system where one family member would be on watch at any given time. And still they could find no reason for the strange activities. The stones seemed to materialise out of thin air, being thrown at the house from nothing. Stones fell from the sky like sheets of rain, battering the houses. And at times the assaults went on for literally hours, with almost every window in the houses being broken. There was even a suggestion that the stones seemed to only be thrown through windows that had someone present in the room, and if that person moved, the stones seemed to follow them. Meaning that whatever was doing this seemed to possess some sort of awareness or intelligence. This went on and on. The families were exhausted, frustrated, frightened, and ultimately confused. They tried everything they could to catch the attackers, and after a week of getting nowhere, they enlisted the help of the authorities. The police took it seriously. Cameras were set up, including motion sensors and infrared cameras, and officers camped out in the victims' gardens. But no answers were forthcoming. But a few things were discovered. There were no fingerprints on any of the rocks, and the rocks seemed to be smooth and polished. Chief Inspector Len Turley reckoned that they had put in more than 1,000 man-hours on this case, and nothing. The families erected corrugated iron and chicken wire around their houses, particularly their windows. The police eventually suggested that the rocks were potentially being hurled with some catapult-type device. But that didn't really solve the mystery. There was no way that the aim could be so accurate if they were fired from a catapult at such a long distance. And surely someone would have seen a catapult launching rocks at a street for hours at a time. It went on for 3 years. And it was never solved. It eventually just petered out on its own. But these types of stories have happened literally all over the world and with no explanation. And today we are focusing on a story that comes from Akron, Ohio in the 1870s. Our story takes place in a neighborhood in Akron that was literally known as Hell's Half Acre. The neighborhood was rough, it was tough, and it was dingy and dirty. At the center of this iron working town, there was a huge blast furnace. This blast furnace roared day and night like the beating heart of the neighborhood. It was hot and suffocating and belched fire and brimstone into the sky constantly. According to the writer Mark Price, the night sky glowed a fiery red, flames seethed, smoke writhed, and acrid soot smudged the air. If this wasn't the devil's domain, it certainly resembled it. It is a fitting backdrop to our story, which centres around the Metzler family, which consisted of Michael, a German immigrant, Maria, a French immigrant, their six children, and Maria's mother Bridget, who lived with them in a house close to the factory. On the 8th of October 1878, Maria, her daughter Elizabeth, and a neighbour were working in the fields surrounding the house. It was a cloudy, dull day, and the three were husking corn in the fields, laborious and repetitive work. With no warning, they were suddenly showered with small stones and clods of earth. Initially, they were shocked and looked around for someone to pinpoint the assault on. But there was no one around, and the stones and clods of earth kept coming. The women ran, seeking shelter in the house, and when Michael returned from the factory that evening, they told him the story. Michael wasn't fazed or freaked out by the story. He knew that the perpetrator had to be one of the local yobs, and he stormed out of the house and collared a young man that he believed was the likely missile launcher. Despite the lad pleading his innocence, Michael believed that he was indeed the perpetrator and went straight to the mayor of Akron to inform him that his family were being targeted by hooligans. The mayor wasn't convinced that he could do anything to alleviate the situation, but Michael hoped that he had scared the local young lads enough that they wouldn't bother his family again. He was, of course, wrong. Soon the family could not leave the house without being showered with stones that were the size of walnuts. They seemed to materialize from above and assailed the heads and shoulders of anyone who left the house. One day in particular, the children were being pelted with stones while working outside the house, and eventually Michael, tired of the situation, sent the children inside the house to shelter from the barrage of pebbles, only for the children to be inside for a short time before running back outside the house screaming that the stones were being pelted at them from inside the house. It was time to call a priest. The Metzler family were deeply Catholic and believed that a priest could rid them of whatever was tormenting their family. That did not go well either. When Father Brown entered into this house and began his prayers, a pebble landed at his feet, and he was struck in his back by another pebble. Pebbles rained from the ceiling and struck the other occupants of the room. The priest reportedly left, but made some interesting claims when he was later approached by reporters. He first said that he had only witnessed one piece of coal being thrown, which landed at his feet. But he believed that it was the work of one of the children who was standing near the coal bucket. This was furiously denied by the Metzlers. But then, interestingly, Father Brown changed his story and stated that the blame was to be put on Bridget, Maria's elderly mother, who also lived in the house. And now, rather than suggesting it was a hoax, he suggested that Bridget was a woman who dabbled in witchcraft and had brought this upon the family. In an interview he gave to the newspaper The Herald, he now stated that the old woman has a bad name. She has the name of healing and curing and such things by words. Witchcraft. I made her leave my congregation for doing that. She has that power like many others who come from the old country, but we don't see much of it here. I thought at first this stone throwing might be the work of her and the second daughter, whom she is possibly instructing in the art. but from the fact that the manifestations, by creating so much talk and drawing such disorderly crowds, must be a great annoyance to the family. I have thought that someone else, possibly possessing the same power, was doing it out of enmity towards her. Bridget Noss was from Alsace-Lorraine, which was formerly Germany but is now in modern-day France. She was a woman who was considered to be versed in the old ways. Despite the fact that this event happened in the late 1800s, there was clearly still a dim view on ideas around witchcraft in this area. It is also important to recognise that until the late 1700s, Germany and France were rife with witch trials, which would have still been in the collective consciousness. And keep in mind, the trial that was considered the last witch trial in America happened in 1878. Bridget was said to have considerable skill and knowledge of healing plants and herbs. She was a midwife and had a deep understanding of what was referred to as secret women's business. There was also a local rumour that she had owned a property hundreds of miles away that was due to be removed from her possession until the stone-throwing mystery, at which point the value of her property dropped and she was able to buy the property back. I'm unsure as to how in the world this worked, but perhaps no one wanted to buy a property that had been occupied by a witch. We're no strangers on this podcast to women being blamed for allegedly supernatural occurrences. An older woman from the old country, in this case Germany, who was adept in the creation of herbal remedies and the understanding of women's reproductive health, was the perfect vessel to appropriate the blame for events that people couldn't explain or understand. But I digress. The crowds began to gather. One day, 6,000 people were jostling in the street in front of the house to get a look into the mysterious dwelling. Tomfoolery was inevitable, and some boys in the crowd began throwing stones for fun, which resulted in one small boy nearly being killed after being struck with a rock. The crowd were outraged, and a stampede began. The police were called in to intervene and try and man the crowd. Reporters flocked to the house to try and get an exclusive about this stone-throwing spook. And because of this, there are recorded eyewitness accounts of the events. One journalist from the Akron Beacon newspaper reported the following. As 10 o'clock drew near, both Mr. and Mrs. Metzler stated that the shower was probably over for the evening, as 9:30 was the usual limit. However, the reporter and a few others remained, and while all were watching each other, one of the party was struck quite sharply on the foot with a pebble, from all that could be seen, thrown by some invisible hand. On examination, it was found to be wet, and fresh earth still adhered to it, showing conclusively that it had come from the yard, having been wet by the evening rain. But there was no opening of any sort through which it could have come from the outside. Presently, another considerably larger passed between Mrs. Metzler and her little daughter, apparently starting from the wall and lighting in the middle of the floor. Neither had moved a muscle at the time, and the bystanders were perfectly satisfied that they were not responsible for the missile. And another reporter stated, in the evening, after dusk, accompanied by friends, he returned to the house, and while his friends were inside with the other members of the family, he made several circuits around the building with Mr. Metzler. These circuits were all at different distances. From all directions, stones came whistling around our heads. They came with a dull, monotonous whistle, and seemed to be in the air at least a quarter of a minute before they reached us. Nothing could be seen to explain how these stones were thrown. And yet another reporter stated that, among the peculiarities of the stone throwing, as related by the family and confirmed by others, are that in their flight they are accompanied by a whizzing sound, and that they are always damp, sometimes only on one side. And Mr. Coomer said that one which he picked up after it fell was cold, as to be painful when held in the hand. It is said also that they fall dead, never rolling or rebounding. The family were absolutely horrified at both the events and the scandal that these events had brought. They didn't want people gathering outside the house to gawk at them. They were terrified of the aggression that was being levied towards Bridget, who was an old woman being accused of evil and witchcraft. They had seen what happened when the crowds got rowdy and belligerent. It was frankly dangerous. The family were God-fearing Catholics, and they were embarrassed and ashamed of the accusations that were being made against them. They earned nothing from the events, only a reputation for being a family with a dark side. And when the poltergeist did what poltergeists do, it just stopped. People's claims were immediately cemented. It was either the old woman, who is definitely a witch, and they always suspected there was something off about her, or it was 9-year-old Emma Metzler. Emma Metzler was described as being a black-eyed little thing who was impish and dogged. She was also 9 years old and working in a local factory, and was the target of such abuse after the stone-throwing incident that she was forced to leave her job at the factory. But despite being repeatedly interrogated by both reporters and police officers, there was never any evidence that Emma was responsible, and she never admitted to any wrongdoing. Equally, Bridget never folded under questioning or interrogation either. In 1929, William Clemens wrote a piece about the incident in the Akron Topic. He wrote, "With a fellow writer, I visited the house in the bright sunshine of an early morning. We entered the living room and closed and locked the two windows and closed and locked the two doors. Stories had reached the outside world that the little girl had, by a very clever trick, thrown the stones. Also, it was whispered that the grandmother was a witch. Now, I sat next to the grandmother and held both her hands. The little girl was perched upon the lap of my companion. Mr. Metzler was away at the factory where he was employed. Mrs. Metzler sat near the stove, knife in hand, paring potatoes. At her feet was a large pan. Thus we had the stage set for tragedy, or for comedy. And what happened? I was asking Mrs. Metzler for her possible explanation of the manifestation. There were tears in her eyes as, holding the knife in an outstretched hand to emphasize her words, she cried, 'It is a curse upon this family.' At that moment, a small stone, the shape and size of a hickory nut, fell, apparently from the ceiling, and struck Mrs. Metzler on the arm. The stone was warm and wet. Later, a larger stone, the size of an egg, fell and struck me on the shoulder, a slight touch, like the tap of a finger. The stone fell at my feet, but did not roll or move from where it fell. Like a piece of putty, it clung to the floor. Still, other stones fell on that eventful morning, all coming apparently from the ceiling. We watched for their coming too, and all appeared to have their origin 8 or 10 inches below the unbroken ceiling plaster. The stones did no damage, but they caused deep wonder. For 2 weeks, such phenomena continued. Scientists were attracted to the scene. Reporters came from distant newspapers. A local newspaper gathered a score of stones and displayed them in its office window on Howard Street, to the amusement of some and the interest of many. All the 100 or more of these stones that fell in and near the Metzler home over a period of 2 weeks were warm and wet, and as they came through the air, a slight whistling noise seemed to bear them company. Police were called to protect the home from the crowds that gathered daily. Meantime, there came no expose of the thrower and no explanation of the throwing. At the end of the fortnight, the latter ceased, as suddenly as it began. What is the answer? No man, scientific or otherwise, came forward to explain. The case baffled us all. It was a mystery, and to this day remains an unsolved mystery. And that was it. The story ended almost as quickly as it started, with no resolution, as is often the way with poltergeist cases. But I think what is most interesting about this particular story is that it is not by any means an isolated event. In the 14 Times article that detailed this story, there is also a list of other stone-throwing cases from around the world. In Australia in 1921, in a place called Gyra, weird stone-throwing targeted the Bowen family home, particularly young Minnie Bowen. Despite extensive police investigations, the source of the disturbances was never identified. In Mayanup, Australia, in the 1950s, Aboriginal farm workers became the centre of two major outbreaks of mysterious stone throwing at Mayanup and Pumfries. The events, which continued for several years, were witnessed by hundreds. In Tucson in the USA in 1983, recently settled into a desert home, the Burke Bigler family became terrified when large rocks started bombarding their houses every evening. The situation escalated to its peak in early December when one attack trapped two reporters inside the house, requiring a police escort to move them to safety. Despite efforts by police and locals to locate the throwers, no culprit was ever found. The events ceased in mid-December. There were the events in Birmingham in 1981, which was detailed at the top of this episode. There was the Humpty Doo poltergeist case in Australia in 1989, which was the subject of a previous podcast episode. There was an event in Naipu in Romania in 2017, when in August the Dobre family were subjected to a constant rain of rocks hitting the roof of their house, as well as other phenomena including objects moving and lights switching on by themselves. The events seemed to be focused on their 11-year-old son, Andre. Seeking help, they called a local priest and the police. The episode ended when Andre visited a well-known monastery. In Sombek in Bhutan in 2019, this case involved the Galli family, with mysterious stone throwing centered around their 15-year-old son, Sunil. Stones bombarded the family's cattle hut and continued even after the family fled and sought refuge elsewhere. The stone throwing persisted until a shaman's ritual appeared to bring a halt to the disturbances. Whatever the answer is for these stone throwing cases, it seems as though they start with no warning, they end with no warning, and unfortunately, there seem to be no answers. I bloody love a stone-throwing poltergeist case. I really do. I really enjoy them. I know they poltergeist cases, and of course the stone-throwing ones, they follow a particular narrative that becomes quite samey if you do them too often, right? So I try and only do them every so often. But I just find them fascinating. Like, firstly, the Birmingham story is wild. I posted about that story on TikTok this week and somebody commented to say that they lived on the street and they could remember the houses with the corrugated iron. And another person commented to say that they were from the local area and they could remember the story as it was happening at the time. And when they were teenagers and kids, they used to be terrified to walk that street at nighttime in the dark. And I understand that in terms of the police intervention in that story, like they obviously spent a huge amount of time investigating this, like 1,000 man hours for this case is wild. And presumably then there was pressure for them to come up with some sort of solution to what was happening. So while they necessarily didn't find anybody that was responsible, at least they could go, well, it's clearly some sort of catapult. And I understand why they needed to say that, because they can't exactly turn around and go, listen, we don't fucking know what's going on around here. It must be a poltergeist. We don't know what else to call a priest. I don't know. But I do firmly believe that if it was somebody catapulting stones at these houses, I think you first of all wouldn't have that maintained accuracy. I just don't think you would. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe my knowledge of catapult devices is limited, but I just don't feel like you'd have that consistent accuracy, first of all. And second of all, somebody would know. People are notoriously bad at keeping secrets. Somebody would know. Somebody would see somebody setting up a catapult every night for hours on end. You know, why were the stones all so uniform? Why were they polished stones, you know? And in terms of the Hell's Acre story, right? Jesus, that neighborhood sounds horrendous. if you imagine, right, that there is some sort of, you know, waiting room or some sort of boardroom for paranormal entities, and they're like, John, this week your assignment is Hell's Acre, and everyone's like, no way, they call it Hell's Acre, that is wild, John, that's hilarious, you barely even have to do any work, you know. It's lucky it was only a stone thrown poltergeist and not an actual full-blown demon end of the world hell's mouth opening up situation. And just to say, it is raining while I'm recording this, and the rain is sort of battering against the window, and if you can hear that, I'm very sorry, but it does sound quite like little pebbles being thrown against the window, so maybe it's appropriate. One of the things that I wrote down in my notes about this story is that, listen, priests never work in poltergeist cases, really, do they? Like, they never seem to work. People call a priest, the priest is like, oh yeah, yeah. They're either kind of going, oh, I'm in way over my head here, or they come bursting in, say some prayers, and the poltergeist is like, lol, and yeets a stone at them, because they just don't seem to work. I feel like poltergeists are sort of, you know, a bit like the fae and those sort of creatures. They seem to operate outside our ideas of good and evil. You know, they're not interested in or impacted by our perceptions of religion as, you know, as human beings. They're just like, whatever, I don't care what words you're jumbling together there, it doesn't make any difference to me. And this particular priest, I was like, you're a bit of a dickhead, you know, you've made some shitty moves. Firstly, you know, a Catholic priest in that era had a pretty significant amount of power in the community, and to go on record to say, well, yeah, it's probably the 9-year-old girl, you know, it's probably her that's doing it. And then to go on record and say, oh, by the way, actually, I changed my mind. The old woman who lived in the house, she's a witch. And he's like, yeah, I had to kick her out of the congregation for doing witchy shit. So it's definitely her. And obviously some other witch that she's having a row with is casting spells on them and showering them with rocks. To me, it sounds like this man was embarrassed by the fact that whatever he meant to do didn't make any difference to the situation, or he was genuinely frightened by the situation and needed to cast blame on some physical living person, and obviously chose the little girl in the household or the old woman in the household, two of the most vulnerable people in the household. He decides to go, yeah, it was definitely them. And surely he must have understood that is putting those two people into considerable danger. And as we saw, Emma had to leave her factory job because she was subject to such abuse over people believing that it was her that was orchestrating these events. I also wrote down that the secret women's business was a direct quote, and I just love that it was secret women's business, and that's what makes you a witch, taking part in secret women's business. I mean, we all know that in a modern context, that could be as simple as a woman going to a woman who had knowledge of healing and being like, I have ferocious period cramps that I cannot function with. Is there any possibility that you have some sort of herbal remedy that can help me? That was also women who would go to these healers and be like, I've been assaulted, or this has happened to me, or I am pregnant with another child. I cannot physically do this, or I can't afford to have another child. And these women with herbal remedies would have potions and things that might bring on a miscarriage, and so on and so forth. So essentially, these women were branded as witches because they were, you know, providing some sort of health care to women. Anyway, there are elements of this story, aside from that, ranting aside, there are elements of this story that I find interesting. So I do find it interesting, and it's only briefly mentioned in one of the extracts, that 9:30 was the usual limit, was what they said. So by 9:30 in the evening, the activity would have stopped. What does that mean? And I wonder, does that coincide with the children going to bed? And I'm not trying to be super cynical, but 9:30 seems like a really specific time for everything to stop. And I know it's ridiculous in a way to try and nitpick at an event that seems completely supernatural and ridiculous and come out of nowhere and start suddenly and end suddenly. But I do think that half nine seems like a really strangely specific time for everything to stop. And there are also discrepancies in the stories. Like, for example, one reporter said that when they picked up the stone, it was cold to the touch, to the point of feeling painful in your hand. Like that sensation, I suppose, if you squeeze an ice cube, it does cause pain. Whereas other reports write that all of the stones were warm to the touch and damp on one side. And I do think those kind of little discrepancies are interesting, because if there's little discrepancies like that in the story, what other discrepancies are there? And at the end of the day, people were trying to sell newspapers. They were trying to sell stories. Of course, they wanted to make the stories juicy and interesting. If a detail didn't fit your narrative or what you were trying to write as a reporter, of course, you might leave something out or change something slightly. I do think it's interesting that the stones and rocks seem to stop dead when they land, as if, you know, I think it was described as if it had landed in putty, like it just sticks to the floor rather than rebounding or skittering, you know, a few feet when it lands or whatever. And interestingly, in the article, they talked about how in the Enfield poltergeist case, the same phenomenon was observed, that when things were thrown by the poltergeist, they seemed to just stop dead when they landed rather than landing and moving forwards as you would imagine something would if it was thrown a considerable distance. I think the final report that we heard, where the writer was saying that, you know, they physically watched these stones seem to fall from like 8 to 10 inches below the ceiling, like they just apparated, appeared there and then fell on whatever member of the household it was. It really felt to me like he had witnessed whatever he had witnessed and was sort of upset or trying to clear the family's name. Obviously, he had heard these stories of witchcraft bandied around and how it was the wee girl who had done it. And it sounded like he was like, no, I want to show people that I went to this house. It wasn't possible for these two people in the household to have done this. I don't know what I saw, but I saw something that was supernatural. I do feel like if these things are supernatural, if these things are paranormal, I feel like it is a manifestation of some sort of heightened emotion in the household that is generally linked to teenagers or younger people in the household. That's what I think. I think if it's not supernatural, it's a pretty impressive prank or a pretty impressive trick. We've seen stories before, like, for example, the haunting of Alma Fielding. We've seen stories where people will go out of their way to fake these particular scenarios because it gets them attention or it causes a disruption to an otherwise, you know, difficult or laborious or menial or what seems menial existence. And I think that's sort of sometimes equally as impressive. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you have a story that you would like to submit to the podcast, you can do so by emailing at reallifeghoststoriespodcast@gmail.com. You can also check out the website, reallifeghoststoriespodcast.com. And if you are desperate for some extra content, you can subscribe to the Patreon. That is patreon.com/reallifeghoststories, where for $5 a month or $2 a month, you get access to heaps of extra content, as well as every single main and mini episode completely ad-free. And on that note, I shall see you next time.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.